Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading the remaining articles from the December 2021 issue of True West Magazine. Should we have time, we'll begin the January 2022 issue of True West. Double-Barreled Justice by Bob Bowes Bell. October 27, 1873. Rowdy Joe Lowe versus Big Redbeard. Molly takes one in the stomach, in his cups and blue whistlers. Big Redbeard is deep in his cups as he goes to his room in the back of the saloon in Delano, Kansas, and returns with his signature shotgun and pistol. Laying the shotgun on the end of the bar, Big Red drinks up before taking his shotgun and stepping outside. Returning an hour and a half later, sans his shotgun, Big Red points his revolver at a white doorknob in the hall and fires. Customer Tom Pope draws his pistol to join in the fun, but Big Red turns and lays his weapon's barrel against Pope's head, warning him to put up his gun or be shot. Someone nervously suggests a dance. Big Red dances for about an hour, then leaves. Bartender Walter Beebe tells two patrons to follow Big Red and try to keep him out of trouble. 10 minutes later, Big Red returns and heads immediately to the east window of the saloon's dance floor, where he stands, brooding for about 5 minutes. Everyone watches him with apprehension. He finally steps back, raises his six gun, and, using both hands, aims and fires. His bullet goes through the window, leaving a gaping hole. Bartender Beebe runs to the hole and sees a shattered window on the building next door. Racing back to the saloon bar, Beebe tells a patron that Big Red must have been shooting at their next-door competitor, Rowdy Joe Lowe. Several minutes later, Rowdy Joe bursts into the saloon, clutching his neck with one hand and holding a shotgun with the other. Fuming, he asks, "Who just shot me?" "I done it," says Big Red, swaying in the dim light beyond the bar. Rowdy Joe pulls his shotgun up to his hip and bellows, "Take it, you sons of bitches," as he cuts loose with both barrels. The bartender later testifies that Lowe had the muzzle elevated and may have been trying to intimidate the crowd rather than kill anyone. The two blasts rake the ceiling and east wall, and a patron at the bar, Billy Anderson, is hit on the bridge of his nose. Several Texas cowboys, in town to celebrate the completion of their cattle drives, scramble for the east door and disappear. Big Red advances, snapping his six-shooter at Rowdy Joe and Kate Lowe, who has followed her husband into the saloon. An eyewitness later testifies it did not go off. Before Big Red can fire again, Kate pushes her man out the side door. Big Red looks around for more targets. He now points his pistol at one of his girls, Josephine Miss Joe Demerit, and sneers, "Did you put up a job on me?" She assures him she did not. He then demands to know where his shotgun is, and she remarks that maybe he left it in town. With that, Big Red throws her on the floor, cocks his pistol, and points it at her. Before he can fire, the bartender and several others jump in, allowing Joe to break loose and flee to the back rooms. The men finally let Big Red up, and he stands in the center of the dance floor for a minute until finally raising his revolver and firing a shot into the darkened hallway that leads to the back rooms. A scream is heard, and the bartender runs to see who has been hit. Beebe finds Annie Franklin, styled in the newspapers as Molly, shot in the stomach. Evidently, Big Red has mistaken her for the object of his wrath, Miss Joe. At some point, Big Red leaves the saloon, probably bound for town to retrieve his shotgun. Meanwhile, Rowdy Joe has returned to his saloon and is reloading his shotgun. Kate dresses his wounded neck, all the while trying to dissuade him from any more bloodshed, but Rowdy Joe will not be denied. He slams the breach and steps out into the cold for another go at Big Red. It isn't long before a shotgun blast reverberates through the night, bringing out everyone from both saloons. Big Red is found prostrate on the Douglas Avenue Bridge with a shattered arm and a ball lodged in his hip. Not long after, Rowdy Joe crosses the bridge and surrenders to the sheriff. Deadly reputation. After running from the attempted murder charge in Delano, the Lowes head to Texas to continue their rowdy ways. Joe and Kate split in 1876. Almost immediately afterward, Joe was married in Fort Worth to Annie Franklin, also known as Molly, the same woman shot and wounded by Redbeard during that fatal confrontation. For her part, Rowdy Kate, post Joe, ran dance halls in Texas. Rowdy Joe's death was a bit anticlimactic. On February 11, 1899, he was in Denver's Walrus Saloon, drunk per usual. He began insulting another customer, E.A. Kimmel, who happened to be an off-duty policeman. Kimmel knew of Joe's deadly reputation. He pulled his gun and shot Lowe to death. Rowdy Joe was unarmed. Kimmel successfully argued self-defense. Author Richard Seltzer believes Rowdy Joe actually got along with most folks. It was his drinking that made him mean and deadly. Aftermath, odds and ends. Big Redbeard lingered in agony for 2 weeks before expiring at 3 a.m. on Tuesday, November 11th. Rowdy Big Joe was found not guilty in the death of Big Red, but he was held on another charge of assault for intending to kill Billy Anderson. After losing his sense of smell and sight from the nose wound, Anderson filed suit against Lowe for damages in the sum of $10,000, but Lowe disappeared. Bartender Beeb was sentenced to 3 years in prison for aiding Lowe in his escape. Miss Joe DeMeritt took over Big Red's business, but she forged ownership of Big Red's property on the deed, was found out, and sentenced to 10 years in the state penitentiary. In 1876, a judge took pity on her plight and helped her receive a pardon. Miss Annie Franklin survived her stomach wound and lived to dance again. After stints in Texas and Colorado, Rowdy Joe settled in Denver and started a family. He became successful in the saloon business, but his old habits finally caught up with him. Still a big drinker, Rowdy Joe was fatally shot in a Denver saloon in 1899, 13 years after he gunned down Big Red. Recommended, Rowdy Joe Lowe, Gambler with a Gun by Joseph G. Rosa and Waldo E. Koop, published by University of Oklahoma Press. True West Magazine, December 2021. Will Comstock, by Joseph G. Rosa. Will Medicine Bill Comstock was an enigma to many of his contemporaries. Some claimed he was a half-breed Cheyenne, and others that he had been stolen by the Indians as a child, but preferred to live with the whites. However, the Junction City Weekly Union of February 9, 1867, reported that he had been born near where Fort Wallace then stood, and was acquainted with all that vast region from the British possessions south to Texas, and that he had never been farther east than Leavenworth, Kansas. In truth, Comstock was neither a half-breed, a stolen child, or Western-born. Rather, he came from genteel Eastern stock and was a grandnephew of James Fenimore Cooper, whose leather-stocking tales of the revolutionary frontier had inspired an ongoing fascination with the West. Born January 17, 1842, in Comstock Township, Kalamazoo, Michigan, William Averill Comstock was orphaned at an early age, and he and his sisters were brought up by relatives. By 1860, however, Young Will was reported to be an Indian trader in Cottonwood Springs, Nebraska Territory, and by the middle 1860s, he was well known as an Indian scout and interpreter. General George Armstrong Custer, in his book, My Life on the Plains, wrote that no Indian knew the country more thoroughly than did Comstock. He was perfectly familiar with every divide, watercourse, and strip of timber for hundreds of miles in either direction. He knew the dress and peculiarities of every Indian tribe and spoke the language of many of them. Custer found him to be very knowledgeable on all manner of subjects and to be the perfect gentleman. Other Army officers shared Custer's opinion, and Comstock's services were always in demand. In fact, it was his presence with the command that prevented what could have led to the deaths of Custer, Hancock, and many of the troops who accompanied them the summer of 1867 in what was recalled as Hancock's Indian War. To understand why, we must go back to 1864 and the Sand Creek Massacre, when Black Kettle's Cheyenne were massacred at Sand Creek. Black Kettle had escaped, as did Edmund Guerrier, the half-breed son of William Guerrier, a French trader, and Tata Toisne, a full-blooded Cheyenne, and his brother-in-law, George Bent. Guerrier, generally known as Ed Geary, never again trusted the whites. In later years, Bent claimed that Ed did his best to lead Custer's troops away from the Indians and warn them in advance, while at the same time he plotted revenge. But once Comstock arrived, with his personal knowledge of Indians and ability to speak their language, Ed realized that it would not be long before Will found out what he was up to and informed Custer. Comstock was known as Medicine Bill among his companions, primarily because of his superstitious nature. Even his evil-looking dog was said to have had a medicine collar. The Indians, however, called him Medicine Bill because Bill had cut off a man's finger in order to save him from a rattlesnake bite. Despite his high reputation among fellow scouts in the Army, there were those who, because of his long association with Indians, regarded Comstock as a renegade. Will, however, dismissed such claims and continued placing him at risk in the fervent hope that peace could be restored to the Plains country. Many who have compared Will Comstock with the likes of Wild Bill, Buffalo Bill, and other well-known scouts and guides have speculated that, with the right kind of publicity, he would have achieved similar nationwide notoriety and enduring fame. But apart from a few inaccurate news reports, he managed to avoid too much attention from the press. As for his so-called rivals, it is believed that he and Hickok knew each other. There is a story that they were both at Monument Station, Kansas, when a bunch of Denver thugs got out of hand and Comstock watched in awe as Hickok beat up their leader for insulting the agent's wife. Insofar as Buffalo Bill Cody was concerned, he claimed to have beaten Comstock in a horseback buffalo hunting contest for the title Champion Buffalo Killer of the Plains. According to Cody, he killed 69 buffalo against Comstock's 46. No contemporary evidence has been found, and we only have Bill's word for it. Early in 1868 at Fort Wallace, Comstock blighted his impeccable record when he confronted H.P. Wyatt, a wood contractor for the post. Wyatt owed him money and refused to pay. Comstock, who was already incensed by Wyatt's claim to have been with Quantrill when he sacked Lawrence, Kansas in 1863, is reported to have pulled his pistol and shot him, some reports say in the back, before making his escape to Hayes City. M. E. Joyce, Justice of the Peace, is reported to have let him go for want of evidence, and by August, Comstock was again scouting for the Army. He and Sharp Grover, another scout, were ordered by Lieutenant Fred Beecher of the Battle of Beecher's Island fame to go to camp of the camp of the Cheyenne chief Turkey Leg to try and persuade him to dissuade his young men from going on the warpath. Both men had lived with the chief and hoped he would cooperate, but the meeting was tense. And though they thought they were being escorted safely from the village, both scouts were shot down and left for dead. Wounded, Grover faked death, and in the darkness made his way to the railroad and was picked up. It has been reported that Will's body was never recovered, but it is now believed that it was and that he was buried at Fort Wallace. As a scout, courier, interpreter, all-round brave and adventurous individual, William Averill Comstock was in a class of his own, an opinion shared by many of his contemporaries. The Omaha Daily Herald, Nebraska, of August 27, 1868, eulogized that he also had the confidence of his officers and many warm friends wherever he was known. Joseph G. Rosa co-edited our September 2001 Wild Bill Hickok Collector's Edition and wrote the definitive biography. They called him Wild Bill, The Life and Adventures of James Butler Hickok. True West, December 2021 edition. Here's the question and answer column by Marshall Trimble. The OK Corral, 40 Rod Whiskey, and Geronimo. Question. I live and work in Tombstone. I was asked by a visitor, what is the cultural significance of the gunfight at the OK Corral, other than everyone seems to know about it? What would you tell them? Amy O'Shaughnessy, Tombstone, Arizona. Answer. The meeting of the two factions near the OK Corral was to settle an issue of control. Did the citizens of Tombstone and Cochise County want to follow the rule of law, or did they prefer a laissez-faire or hands-off style of government? Some of the factors, Democrats versus Republicans, town versus rural, and to a lesser extent, there were Civil War overtones as well. But in a very real sense, the greatest significance of the fight has been in popular culture. Movies, TV, articles, books, that not only kept the incident alive, but have made it well known around the world. Question. During the Battle of the Alamo in March 1836, what flag was flown by the defenders? Roberta S. De Leon, Morgantown, West Virginia. If you want to believe the many movies Hollywood and others have produced about the Alamo, it was the Mexican tricolor of red, white, and green, modified by having 1824 sewn into the white stripe. There is no evidence such a flag ever flew over the Alamo. In fact, if there was a Texan battle flag at the Alamo, none of those who survived had any memory of it. Question. What was 40 Rod Whiskey? James Cramer, Gary, Indiana. Answer. 40 Rod Whiskey is a fastidious allusion to whiskey, so strong it supposedly can kill at that distance. It was also known as Taos Lightning, or by other local colloquialisms. There were various recipes for making the stuff. Grain alcohol, a twist of tobacco, red chilies, a bar of soap, a rattlesnake's head, and a little Gila river water. They'd mix up a barrel, and when they thought it was ready, they'd drop a horseshoe in it. If the horseshoe sank, they'd stir in more alcohol until the horseshoe rose to the top. Question. I was watching the old television series Johnny Yuma, and the lyrics of the theme song sung by Johnny Cash says, "Where the only law is a hook and a draw." What does that mean? Art Graham, Rapid City, South Dakota. Answer. Jim Dunnan, president of the Wild West History Association and one of the nation's best fast draw artists, says that the hook refers to hooking the trigger guard as you draw the revolver from the holster. He says the index finger needs to be wrapped in front of the trigger guard during a draw. Also, the thumb needs to be parallel with the ground so that the thumb joint wraps around the hammer. It is not possible to shoot yourself. All such accidents were due to improper grip. Question. What Old West period was the most dangerous period of the Southwest? Ron Harper, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Answer. In my opinion, it would be 1861 until around 1886. The Bascom Affair at Apache Pass, January 1861, set the Chiricahua Apaches on the warpath, along with the Yavapai and Tonto Apaches in the rugged Central Mountains. Under the skilled leadership of Mangus, Coloradus, and Cochise, the Apaches were a formidable fighting force. This made the Southwest, to use the old Kentucky phrase, a dark and bloody ground. All this coincided with the Civil War, which caused the military posts to be abandoned as troops were transferred to fight in the East. And while Cochise made peace in 1873, the Yavapai and Tonto people were subjugated at around that time. It still wasn't that safe. Roving bands of outlaws, range wars, mercantile and land fights, and more, pitted large groups against one another. There were occasional conflicts between U.S. citizens and Mexicans. Some Apache uprisings, led by Geronimo, continued until 1886, when the various bands finally settled on the reservations. But by that time, things had settled down to a great degree. True West Magazine, January 2022 edition. Yellowstone, Protected Forever, by Stuart Rosebrook. The 150th anniversary of the first national park commemorates the beginning of America's grand and wonderful national parks and monuments system. On March 1, 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant signed into law congressional legislation that created Yellowstone National Park, the first of its kind in the world. As reported in the Helena, Montana Weekly Herald on March 28, 1872, Yellowstone, embracing an area of 575,000 square miles, covers the sources of the Yellowstone and Missouri rivers, together with all the natural wonders and transcendent scenery of that romantic and incomparable locality. It will heretofore be known to the world as Yellowstone National Park and will be visited in the years to come by thousands of the scientific and the curious, seeking to become acquainted with this unparalleled section of America's wonderland. Just 1 year earlier, Secretary of State Columbus Delano tapped geologist and Civil War physician Ferdinand Vandeveer Hayden to lead a major geological survey of the headwaters of the Yellowstone River and the Yellowstone region of Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho territories. Dr. Hayden, an Army veteran, had had a desire to survey the Yellowstone region since he had first ventured into the region before the Civil War started. Hayden built a 50-man survey team that included artists Thomas Moran and Henry W. Elliott, and adventurous Civil War and landscape photographer William Henry Jackson. Little did Elliott, Jackson, or Moran know that their resulting maps, sketches, art, and photography of Yellowstone would influence Congress and President Ulysses S. Grant's decision to create the national park. In honor of the sesquicentennial of Yellowstone National Park, and the beginning of the most influential national park and monument system in the world conservation movement, Yellowstone survey photographs and Western survey photographs made at the many future national parks, monuments, and forests created after 1872 illustrate this issue's Best of the West selections. True West, January 2022 edition, A Real Woman Bandit, by John Bossenecker. Pearl Hart was a wildcat on and off the outlaw trail. Few Old West outlaws have had so many myths written about them as Pearl Hart, the Arizona stage robber. Despite the legends, Pearl, unlike almost every notorious woman of the Old West, was a real frontier bandit. For the last 100 years, misinformed Western writers have featured a plethora of purported female Western desperados. However, few of these wild women were outlaws. Annie Oakley was a sharpshooter and performer, not a criminal. Calamity Jane, true name Martha Jane Canary, claimed to have been a U.S. Army scout, but in fact she was a frontier prostitute and camp follower. Eleanor Dumont, better known as Madame Mustache, was a Western gambler, not a desperado. Many writers have claimed that Belle Starr, 1848 to 1889, was a frontier robber, and she is known today as the Bandit Queen of Oklahoma. In fact, Belle Starr was primarily a consort of outlaws. Although she was once convicted of horse theft, she never robbed anyone. Pearl Hart's true story has been long lost in the mists of the past. Her real name, her real background, and her real adventures have been lost and replaced by folklore and fiction. But today, genealogical data banks and digital newspaper sites have provided the key in unraveling the facts of her life. She was born Lily Davy in Lindsay, Ontario, Canada in 1871, and raised by an abusive, rapist father and a kindly but badly abused mother. Several times, she and her younger sister ran away from their troubled, impoverished home, hopping freight trains and dressing as boys to ward off unwanted sexual advances. There was no social safety net in that era, so Lily and her sisters, all physically attractive, turned to prostitution for survival. Arizona bound. After many misadventures, Lily married an abusive, morphine-addicted piano player named Dan Bandman. In 1893, she fled her violent husband and went west. In 1894, Lily landed in Arizona Territory, where she adopted the alias Pearl Hart and found work in brothels in Tucson and Phoenix. She later said that she came up with the idea of robbing a stagecoach in order to get enough money to return to her mother in the Midwest. Pearl teamed up with an out-of-luck miner named Joe Boot. They procured horses, guns, and supplies, and rode out of the mining town of Globe in late May 1899. Pearl dressed like an Arizona cowboy, with wide-brimmed hat, men's knee boots, six-shooter, and rifle. The two rode through Pioneer Pass, then descended into Cane Spring Canyon. According to a journalist of the day, the road at that point is one of the worst in the Southwest, following the bed of a creek. The trail was steep and skirted high cliffs. Finally, Pearl and Joe rode into Riverside on the Gila River. It was a small settlement with a stagecoach stop and a population of about 50. Nearby, they made camp and watched the coaches as they came in and out of the station. Pearl and Joe soon figured out the stage schedule and learned that Wells Fargo guards did not regularly ride the road from Globe. That was good news, for only a few daring or very stupid bandit would tangle with a Wells Fargo shotgun messenger. Several townsfolk spotted the two strangers in Riverside, and one of them later said that the holdup plan originated with Pearl, not Joe. The witness overheard them discussing a possible robbery, and Boot declared, "I can never do it. Never, never, never." "But you must. We must," she insisted. "And it's easy. All you'll have to do will be to hold your gun out straight and keep quiet. I'll do the rest." The robbery. On May 29, 1899, the pair rode out of their camp near Riverside, splashed their horses across the Gila River, and headed back to Cane Spring Canyon. Pearl later told the story. On the afternoon of the robbery, we took our horses and rode over the mountains and through the canyons, and at last hit the Globe Road. We rode along slowly until we came to a bend in the road, which was a most favorable spot for our undertaking. We halted and listened till we heard the stage. Then we went forward on a slow walk till we saw the stage coming around the bend. We then pulled to one side of the road. Joe drew a .45 and said, "Throw up your hands." I drew my little .38 and likewise covered the occupants of the stage. Joe said to me, "Get off your horse." I did so while he kept the people covered. He ordered them out of the stage. They were a badly scared outfit. I learned how easily a job of this kind could be done. Joe told me to search the passengers for arms. I carefully went through them all. They had no pistols. Joe motioned toward the stage. I advanced and searched it, and found the brave passengers had left two of their guns behind them when we ordered them out of the stage. Really, I can't see why men carry revolvers, because they almost invariably give them up at the very time when they were made to be used. They certainly don't want revolvers for playthings. I gave Joe a .44 and kept the .45 for myself. Joe told me to search the passengers for money. I did so, and found on the fellow who was shaking the worst, $390. This fellow was trembling, so I could hardly get my hand in his pockets. The other fellow, a sort of a dude, with his hair parted in the middle, tried to tell me how much he needed the money, but he yielded $36, a dime, and two nickels. Then I searched the remaining passenger, a Chinaman. He was nearer my size, and I just scared him to death. His clothes enabled me to go through him quickly. I only got $5, however. The stage driver had a few dollars, but after a council of war, we decided not to rob him. Good-hearted Bandit. Pearl gave another account in which she provided more details. When the coach came into sight, we rode down into the canyon to meet it. Our masks were lost in going to the camp, but we didn't mind that, so on we rode. As we came upon the coach, the driver reined his horses to have a word with us, as travelers out there do. And as the three passengers stuck their heads out to see why the stop was made, we covered them and ordered all four men to line up outside. While Joe kept their hands up at the point of a Winchester, I searched the men. I had to pull off one of my gloves to do this, and in this way, the men saw by my hand that I was a woman. I can still see the Chinaman, who was one of the passengers, holding our horses. He was smiling at the thought that he was so kind we would not rob him. You can bet he was smiling on the other side of his face when I was through with him. I left about $2 for each man and told them to continue their journey and not to look back under penalty of being shot. Pearl later claimed that after returning the driver's money, she told him with a laugh, "You may keep that. I believe you've earned it by driving three such cowards across the hills." Pearl added that after giving a few dollars back to the passengers, she told them, "Being a good fellow, I kind of hate to see you folks dead broke, so I'll stake you all. And now, take a run back along the trail for the good of your health." Then, watching the stagecoach disappear along the canyon, she exclaimed, "Come on, Joe." The two then walked to the spot where their horses were tied, mounted up, and rode off. Pearl's account was reasonably accurate and differed slightly from the details later provided by the stage driver, his passengers, and lawmen. She and Joe set up their ambush at a spot in the Cane Spring Canyon that was 4 miles from the Gila River. It was a narrow, twisting bend where the driver could not see more than 20 feet ahead of his lead horses. The outlaws waited for 3 hours for the coach to arrive. It was 5 p.m. when the stage from Globe came rattling down the rough trail. It was not a large six-horse Concorde coach of the type commonly seen in television and film. Instead, the stage was a much lighter conveyance that looked like a carriage, known as a mud wagon. It had three seats, a canvas top, and a four-horse team. At the ribbons, or reins, was stage driver Henry Bacon. He had three passengers, Oscar J. Neal, a traveling salesman, an old man named Harding, and a Chinese passenger whose name was never recorded. Pearl and Joe stepped out from the roadside brush, and Joe called out, "Halt!" Bacon pulled back on the reins and quickly set the brake. "Climb out of there," Joe barked. The driver and passengers meekly complied, even though Bacon and Neal were armed with large revolvers. Pearl and Joe lined the four men up and went through their pockets. From Neal, they took $390, his pistol, and a gold pocket watch worth $50. Henry Bacon coughed up his six gun and $8, but Pearl handed the money back to him. They relieved the Chinese passenger of $30. The bandits took $40 from the other passenger, Harding. However, before climbing out of the stage, Harding had slipped into his mouth a tobacco pouch holding $80 in gold. A journalist who later interviewed the passengers wrote, "He presented a ludicrous appearance with his cheeks swelled out and the strings of the pouch hanging from his lips. The highwayman failed to notice it, however." Joe Boot did most of the talking, probably because Pearl did not want her voice to reveal that she was a woman. The only words she actually spoke were to one of the passengers who was slow in handing over his cash. Pearl barked, "Cough up, partner, or I'll plug you." After completing the search, Pearl handed back four silver dollars to each of the victims. The passengers later said that they were convinced that the smaller of the two robbers was a woman. Her figure had only been illy concealed by the crude garb she wore of rough shirt and blue overalls, the latter tucked into coarse boots that were plainly far too large. Under the dirty cowboy hat, there showed a curl or two of dark hair, and the hands that had deftly turned their pockets inside out were small and white. Joe then ordered the men back into the stage. Henry Bacon whipped up his team, and the coach lurched off toward Riverside. Pearl and Joe then mounted their horses and fled south, headed for the Southern Pacific Railroad. A sheriff's posse was soon in pursuit. The lawmen managed to capture the pair after a long manhunt. The case made newspaper headlines across the country, for a woman stage robber was unheard of. Pearl soon broke out of jail, was recaptured after another manhunt, and became the most famous convict ever lodged in Yuma prison. Thus began even more adventures for Pearl Hart, but that is another story. In an era when a woman's role was domestic, cooking, cleaning, working on the family farm, raising children, and attending church, Pearl Hart violated every one of society's taboos. She swore, smoked, drank, robbed, rode hard, broke jail, and used men with abandon. The Old West never saw another woman like her. Joe Bossenecker has studied and written about the history of outlaws and lawmen of the Old West for more than 50 years, and has authored books and dozens of magazine articles on the subject. A real woman bandit, Pearl Hart was a hellcat on and off the outlaw trail, is an exclusive excerpt from his new book, Wildcat, The Untold Story of Pearl Hart, the Wild West's Most Notorious Woman Bandit. Hanover Square Press, 2021. True West Magazine, January 2022 edition. Mr. Authenticity by Phil Spangenberger. Many fans of Westerns, especially the True West maniacs, are guilty of picking them apart for the anachronisms all too often found in such films. I recall having a conversation about the 1969 flick Little Big Man with a friend who raved on about it, and I answered that although I enjoyed the film, there were several period errors in it. By the time I'd picked it apart, he commented, "Gee, I thought I liked it until I talked to you." For the past 40-plus years, I've had the opportunity to put in my 2 cents on a number of movies, television shows, and live theater, striving to give Westerns a more authentic look. For my humble efforts, I've been honored with Hollywood's Cowboy Oscar, the prestigious Golden Boot Award for achievements in film and live Western entertainment. I've also earned the nickname of one of Hollywood's hired guns, and have been told that the gun leather my Red River Company supplied to various prop houses was largely responsible for starting the trend of seeing more authentic holsters and belts on the screen. While serving as a technical or historical advisor consultant, I've learned that one can only advise as to what to correct, not dictate. Producers and directors have the final word, and they are often quick to remind the expert that the production is a dramatic story, not a documentary. Nonetheless, I've done my best to add to the realism of every production. Hollywood Calls. Although I'd produced and performed in live Wild West shows in the U.S. and abroad, and worked on small independent films for years, my career with Hollywood movies and TV started around 1979, when a call came from my friends at Stembridge Gun Rentals, then located on the Paramount movie lot. My relationship with them had begun years before, when I obtained firearms from them for use in the Wild West shows I performed in around the globe. When I was the Black Powder editor at Guns and Ammo Magazine, GNA, Sid Stembridge called and asked if I could help prop man Bud Shelton select some authentic firearms for Charlton Heston's then-latest movie, The Mountain Men, 1980. Bud had purchased several commercially produced so-called Hawken muzzle-loading rifles, but they were too modern-looking with their polyurethane-coated stocks, short blued barrels, and brass furniture. Unfortunately, Shelton said he had already purchased them and had to use them. When I suggested that I knew an artisan who could give them a proper 1830s look, he agreed to have them uglified. The guns were sent to my longtime pal, Frank Costanza, who within about 10 days transformed these modern-looking smoke poles into what looked like well-used, cut-down, tack-decorated, with rawhide repairs, frontier-era Plains rifles, the real deals. Everyone was so pleased with how authentic these guns now looked that I was asked to train Heston in the use of the muzzle loaders. Jumping at the chance to meet and work with one of my favorite actors, this Black Powder enthusiast was soon found on a reserved firing line at Angeles Shooting Range in Northeast L.A., showing the man who portrayed Moses, El Cid, Andrew Jackson, and so many other historical icons how to manage my Green River Rifle Works Hawken and Caplock pistol. As an added bonus, director Richard Lang invited me to be a mountain man extra in the movie's rendezvous sequence, and eventually I wound up traveling to the Jackson Hole, Wyoming location for about 10 days to do some additional coaching and background work with a passel of muzzle-loading Amigo extras. My involvement became a lead story in GNA and a featured spot on ABC TV's The American Sportsman. Incidentally, much credit for the overall authentic look and feel of that fur trade era movie goes to friend and renowned Western artist Jerry Crandall and his wife Judy, who were technical consultants and were present during filming. When I worked at GNA, calls would come in from Stembridge and various film producers seeking firearms information. I suggested to the Long Riders, 1980, prop people, that one or more of the James Younger gang used Smith & Wesson Schofields, since they were known to have carried them. Stacy Keach's Frank James character packs one in the film. Another time, I suggested the use of the Auto Mag pistol and connected the filmmakers with Harry Sanford, then president of the Auto Mag Corporation, so they could acquire two, made from leftover parts, for Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry 1983 action thriller Sudden Impact. I'm particularly proud of having played a small part in the Australian Western Quigley Down Under, 1990, by suggesting they use the 1874 Sharps rather than a percussion breech-loading rifle that could not produce any believable accuracy at 1,200-plus yards, and put the producers in touch with Shiloh Rifle Manufacturing Company in Big Timber, Montana. On set with firearms. Sadly, a couple of tragic incidents in Hollywood led to more work in film for me. After a couple of unfortunate gun mishandling accidents that caused the death of two young popular actors, I received a call from a studio prop man who was giving a two-day seminar on firearm safety. He had his classes divided into specific genres: military, law enforcement, full auto, and more. I was brought aboard to host the class on guns for the Western period. I did so while dressed in an Old West frock coat outfit, accompanied by my wife Linda, who appeared in a Victorian bustled day dress to show the many places in 19th century garments a woman could hide firearms. After my firearms handling and safety discussion, I performed a fancy gun handling and blank shooting demonstration a la Wild Bill Hickok. At the conclusion of the class, I was approached about working with Mel Gibson for his 1994 production of Maverick. After a successful audition with the film's production people, including Mick Rogers, stunt coordinator, and Gibson's stunt double, I soon found myself in Mel's production offices. I must say that Mel and most of the big names I've worked with were a joy to be around. Mel in particular was a quick and eager learner, whose on-screen fast and fancy gun handling with an 1873 Colt Peacemaker proved to be an excellent calling card for me for years afterward. Also helpful was the fact that our initial one-hour session was videotaped, and a few moments of my gun coaching with Mel made it to a televised Making of Maverick special. Boom time. The mid-1990s was a booming time, pun intended, for Westerns, and I was kept quite busy. This latest rage with Trail Dust sagas brought the opportunity to work with Rob Lowe for Frank and Jesse, 1994. Armand Assante's 1994 HBO odor, Blind Justice, as well as Lightning Jack with Paul Crocodile Dundee Hogan, 1994, and with Patrick Swayze and Catherine O'Hara in that same year's Tell Tall Tale. As the cowboy craze receded, film work still came my way as an on-camera talking head, historical interviewee, and or behind the scenes as a consultant, and sometimes wrangling horses, including my own, on a host of History Channel series, the popular Tales of the Gun, Modern Marvels, and others. While I was working on the cable network shows, along with hand-doubling actors for trick gun scenes, including twirling a pair of power drills for a scene in TV's Parker Lewis Can't Lose, calls came in for more A-pictures. Coaching Will Smith in some fancy gun work for 1999's Wild Wild West, and a one-day flintlock loading stint with Mel Gibson again for The Patriot, 2000, produced more opportunities to add my 2 cents worth of authenticity for movies. For that Mel Gibson epic, I spent several sessions getting Heath Ledger and a 12-year-old Trevor Morgan to where Heath could load and fire a Brown Bess flintlock musket at the same rate as a British soldier of the 1770s, 3 shots per minute, while little Trevor, who was but a few inches taller than Miss B's, fired his own trio in 70 seconds flat. Safety first. When training or working on set with actors, we took special care while loading and handling any gun. We wouldn't hand the actor any loaded firearm until the moment before action was called and filming commenced. We instructed actors to treat any gun as loaded, never aim directly at anyone, and to point any firearm at an angle slightly off to the side of their make-believe adversary in a safe direction. Camera angles can adjust to give the desired look. Firearm safety was always our utmost concern, and we've never had any accidents with guns. While working on various projects, my goal was to add little bits of realism, not only in the type of guns used for the different eras and westerns, but also the gun leather, period costuming, and other areas that depict the film's time frame more accurately. In November 2002, I was on location in South Dakota, schooling 50 of 150 cavalrymen extras assigned to me in the dismounted drill and manual of arms with trapdoor Springfield carbines, circa 1890, for the Touchstone Pictures movie Hidalgo, released in 2004. Director Joe Johnston teased me, saying I had my own army since I had formed all of the troopers into squads of 25 men each for ease of management. He laughed, but said he appreciated that I had them under control and not wandering around aimlessly. Fortunately, I had friend Jim Hatzell, a technical consultant himself on many westerns, act as a second in charge, along with some military veterans who pitched in as our regiment marched informally to the fort when troopers were called for on-camera shots. Movie magic. Working in movies has been fun, and some of the most rewarding experiences were working with small production crews, as we did for shows like the History Channel's highly popular Wild West Tech series, which ran for 3 years, 2003 to 2005. On an independent, non-union project, one often wears many hats, and historical advice is generally appreciated by all. Having played a part in many of the episodes filmed for that series, either as a consultant, an on-camera interviewee, an actor, assistant director, wrangler, or just helping out in a number of ways, I had some of the most fun and worked on shows that I'm quite proud of. On these productions, I had the opportunity to work closely with my pal, Al Frisch, of Hollywood Guns and Props. And together, we feel we definitely affected the overall look of those programs. We were able to use period-correct firearms, saddles and tack, costuming, even casting many of the character shots in those colorful shows. Eventually, we had our own stock company of players for these and other projects we were involved with, including the History Channel's Conquerors and Texas Rangers, the Discovery Channel's Unsolved History, American Hero Network's Secrets of the Arsenal, and others. Of all the movie magic tricks we use to add realistic touches to a show, one bit of creativity that stands out in this Westerner's mind was for a sequence about buffalo hunting. It was a scene where Fritch and I set up a hide hunting camp with two men skinning an animal on camera. However, because of the difficulty in obtaining a real animal carcass, we created a dummy critter using a taxidermy buffalo head and shoulder mount, a tanned hide, and several boxes and blankets stuffed up underneath. Once we rounded the hide off, giving it the appearance of a dead buff, it was filmed from the animal's hide side, where the skinners worked on the stomach side with hands and skinning knives bloodied. Even from a couple of feet away, it looked like they were actually skinning a buffalo. That's just one example of the extra effort we put forth to give a film authenticity. On any project I've been involved in, My goal has always been to make it look authentic. I sincerely hope the audience feels that we have succeeded. True West Magazine, January 2022 edition. Cave Creek Ambush. December 22, 1873. Tonto Apaches versus Al Sieber and the 5th Cavalry. Stationed at Camp McDowell, northeast of Phoenix, A.T., a unit of the 5th Cavalry, led by Walter S. Schuller, has been on the hunt since December 1st, looking for Bronco Apaches, Indians who have left their reservation. Under Schuller's command are 11 enlisted men, 25 mules carrying supply and ammunition, numerous civilian packers, and 14 Indian scouts, led by Chief of Scouts Al Sieber. The party scouts east of the Verde River and north of the fort, finding nothing. Crossing to the west side of the river, the patrol heads southwest, and some of the Apache scouts climb New River Mesa to get a look at the surrounding area. They find fresh signs of Tonto Apache activity. After a cold night on the mesa above Elephant Butte, the scouts track signs down to Cave Creek to a cave on the west bank of the stream. The scouts locate 11 wikiups, brush huts, cleverly concealed and hugging the cliff wall. The scouts report their find to Lieutenant Schuller, but he is afraid the hostile Tonto Apaches have already spotted the troops. If his force attacks straight on, the Apaches may escape into the rough hillocks northwest of Black Mountain. Schuller decides to guide the troop train westward to the Agua Fria River, making it appear the soldiers haven't seen the renegade enclave. After a day in camp, the troops openly march eastward along Camp McDowell Road, south of the present-day Carefree Highway. Schuller is gambling the Apache lookouts, who are surely watching, will assume the soldiers are heading back to the fort. He is correct. A few days before Christmas, Schuller, Sieber, and the Apache scouts quietly creep up alongside Cave Creek until they are opposite the Apache camp. Once the first rays of morning break across the sky, the ambush party opens fire from its rocky concealment, killing 9 Tontos. An untold number of Indians flee in panic and escape as the soldiers burn several tons of food. Aftermath, odds, and ends. Lieutenant Walter S. Schuller and his troops returned to Camp McDowell the next day. Several more skirmishes were fought in the Cave Creek area until the Apaches were successfully corralled on reservations. The last skirmish of the Apache Wars fought in Arizona was in 1882, but there's another classic gunfight. Several years ago, a group of Apache war buffs came to Cave Creek armed with the lieutenant's report and a couple of metal detectors, and they scoured the infamous cave for which Cave Creek is named. At previous Apache battle sites the buffs had visited, including Horseshoe Canyon and Dragoon Mountain's South Pass, they discovered numerous bullets and casings. Unfortunately, they didn't find any bullets in the biggest and most well-known cave, Cave Creek. The Army report doesn't specifically name the cave the battle was fought in. Several other caves are in the area, but none are big enough to hold 9 huts. And so it remains a mystery as to where the December fight took place.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.